broader sense of national security. Probably the most important thing on this slide is for 10 of the last 11 years, we have been the safest national laboratory in the entire complex. And 1 year we came in second. And it really, you know, who cares if you're first or second? What's important is our people work safely, they go home safely, and our neighbors and our region can trust that we're doing this really hazardous work in very safe and predictable ways. Our job is really not to bring in revenue. Our job is to address important national challenges. And there are plenty of them out there today. And we've heard all this whole session on the need to remediate tank waste. No question about it. We've got to get that put into a safer configuration. In 2008, we had a meeting in Prague where we said we were going to get rid of all nuclear weapons. Well, guess what? It seems to be going in the other direction right now. In fact, the Soviets have doubled their budget for their nuclear program. China, India, who even wants to talk about what could happen in the Middle East? The strength and reliability of our nuclear deterrent is critical. This laboratory, without this laboratory, the nation doesn't have a nuclear deterrent. Simple as that. There are a lot of people with bad intentions, and there are a lot of materials out there that we would never want them to get their hands on. And so helping our nation and the world do a better job of securing those materials is paramount. And then in the final quadrant there, energy. Wow, what a flip from where we were just 5 years ago. We were desperate trying to figure out where we're going to get enough energy to power this country. And now with the alternative gas and oil reserves that we're finding, the real question is how do we be smart about the good fortune we have and move forward in a way that continues to have an economically sound but balanced portfolio of energy going forward. We've heard a lot today about the EM program. This laboratory works at every single one of the EM sites. And it's a real rewarding to me to hear our partners talk about little particles they can filter. These are some of the most sophisticated nanoscale materials man has ever made. And they allow those kind of separations that where you don't need to go in and do another chemical step. But they're designed by our scientists in ways where, to an engineer, they look like a particle they can just filter out. They don't really need to see all of that, but it's all built into it. We've talked a lot about the extractant chemistries. This is a very sophisticated challenge of separating out the cesium from a really high salt concentration. And what it required was tailoring the quantum mechanical character of these little pockets so that the electron overlap would promote cesium and exclude other salts. And then turning that into a chemical that you can put into a giant vat, into a mixture, and it behaves just like something you can trust. So we provide the science that allows these guys to do the engineering with high confidence. It's kind of like my iPhone. I mean, I can push the button and find out where the restaurant is that I'm trying to get to. I don't have to know everything about how it works, but the science is built into it that allows me to do this. One of our, you know, I think one of the things we all have to be concerned about is this is not a short-term challenge we have. We're going to be working on this as a nation for decades to come. And many of our really highly trained and experienced workers in this field aren't going to be here in those decades. Where are we going to get that next generation? So we've stepped up at the laboratory. We're now operating the Minority Serving Institution Program for DOE's EM and really connecting it to the laboratories across the complex to make sure that we're letting these students know about the challenges that are out there and how they can contribute. And this is very exciting new development. And then our lab is actually getting called on to go in and answer some tough questions. So we just published the report for the secretary on the technical cause of the WIP release. And so these are the kind of things that you go to a trusted source, bring in the right experts, and really get an answer that you can build on, the science you can trust, so that you can now develop technological and engineering solutions that you can go forward with. Our work at Hanford is growing. It is a large part of my portfolio now. And you might ask, why are we bothering to help them? They're just trying to get all our money. But frankly, if they don't start making progress, they're going to get all the money. They're going to get all of the money. And we need to help them do a better job. We absolutely do. And so our lab is dedicated to that. And I'm looking at establishing an office in Hanford because we just are there so much that we need to be engaged with that.
Here, Mike,
what's PNNL's? We partner very closely with PNNL. I think the good example was these advanced solvents. We worked with Oak Ridge on the quantum chemistry, and then we turned it into a chemical engineering capable solvent. So it's really, we're more of a engineering technology that interfaces to the science. So PNNL is a very science-oriented laboratory, and that's how we work with them as well. As I said, almost half of our work is in national security. And that picture on the left is a tritium reprocessing plant. That used to be a two-story tall cryogenic building on site. That's one we just sold to the University of Rochester. You put it in the back of your van and drive it there. The whole thing fits in a suitcase, basically. And they're using it for their advanced fusion energy work. Our work in event signatures is something that's, I can't say a whole lot about, but I can tell you with the national security establishment in Fort Gordon, we are building stronger and stronger programs in this region. This is going to become a real center for cyber and national security activities. And of course, we maintain the FBI's laboratory for nuclear forensics, world's only capable laboratory for radiological evidence. And the mobile plutonium facility is an invention of ours of a completely mobile radiological laboratory that can be transported anywhere in the world, set up. It can receive materials, analyze them, repackage them, and stabilize them for transport out. And as we just did a cold weather test of that in Alaska to see how well it works. We're hoping someday to get a call from a cold weather place somewhere a little bit north of South Korea to come and take their materials. We'll see how that works. But we're ready in case they call. We did this for Libya, of course, you know. So when they said, we don't want this material anymore, that was the kind of work that we did there. And we continue to contribute to the energy portfolio. It's not a big piece of what this laboratory does, but we try and take things that we're good at and really work with regional partners. And of course, we continue to be the DOE's Center of Excellence for Hydrogen, but we're now expanding that to looking at storage of natural gas. Remember I talked about we're going to have all this natural gas. What are we going to do with it? Boy, it would be nice if it could replace our transportation fuel. And so we held a national workshop looking at what would it take to do that. And one of the things it takes is a better way to store the gas. And so we're working with Ford Motor Company and BASF on a different technology where you could refill your natural gas vehicle at home. That would be a game changer. Of course, safer nuclear fuels. And working our partnership with Clemson and the regional utilities and industrial partners in the wind turbine drivetrain facility in Charleston, really built to test these giant offshore wind turbines, but it happens to have the world's largest smart grid test facility. And so now we're actually developing that as a separate entity with Clemson as a place where vendors can come and test out their smart grid components and test methodologies for smart grid implementation. And then, of course, it all happens because of our people. And this is a picture of Brenda Garcia Diaz. She was just awarded the governor's award for excellence in science for a young researcher. We're very proud of her, but we're proud of the whole crew of really excellent scientists and engineers we have at the lab. Our work is worldwide. We operate in about 50 different countries, and We're growing our support to help the Japanese in the recovery of the Fukushima. Our technical assistance programs are helping countries around the world learn how to handle and safely store or even remove the materials that are at risk for proliferation. We actually have a lot of international collaborations in nuclear packaging. And so we actually certify and design new packages that allow people to safely contain this material. And our technologies for non-proliferation protocols are now being used around the world. And one of the advantages we have is since we're on a operating industrial-scale nuclear site, we can test those out and demonstrate how well they work in a real condition. Another role of ours is as a national laboratory is to help with economic development and to build the private sector. Now, it's not our primary job, it's our missions, and those first four slides, that's what we really do. But there's a lot of technology that can be taken over into the private sector side. So we have agreements with companies in 24 states around the country. I think we right now have about 100 ongoing programs. As an example, one of them is a system that allows you to store hydrogen and a fuel cell that would replace all of the battery packs for soldiers. You get 5 times the energy density you get with a lithium-ion battery. They're looking at building a large-scale plant to scale this up now. This could really take off. They're in the Bay Area. We have 10 here in South Carolina. I wish we had more. I wish we had a better focus on how the state and the national laboratory work together to get some of these ideas into the small businesses that are developing in this state. There are some pretty good ideas of other states are doing, and we need to look at some of those and figure out if we can adapt them here. We just published our strategic plan. This might be something when you can't sleep well, you could pull it up on our web, take a look at it. But it's an important document for us to really. There was a point when I came to this lab where it was really, we're going to close this thing down. Well, now we're really thinking about where its future is. And one of the things that's really important to the future here is to recognize that all of these are really manufacturing jobs. We think about it like it's cleanup, but you're actually manufacturing waste forms. You're manufacturing a product that is safe and can be stored and can be handled. And there's a revolution in the technology of manufacturing, additive manufacturing, process modeling, virtual reality simulation of these processes. You look at the chemical industry, since the big events they had like Bhopal, they do all their high hazard stuff in smaller modular ways so they don't have to deal with a large scale event. Kind of like the ARP MCU actually is a good example of that. We need to bring that into this industry. And there are challenges in that because this is a very high hazard. You don't make more than one mistake here. And it's highly regulated. So you have to have a place where regulators, industry, the DOE, and universities work together to really bring these technologies forward. And so we're working with the department right now on a concept for a collaborative facility that would really build off of the strong manufacturing core in the state, but allow that to really grow into a lot of different directions, one of which would be in the nuclear side, but really apply to the broader range of manufacturing aspirations for the state. So we're really proud of the science and technology we bring and the rigor we bring to it that people can count on the result, that the engineers can take that product and actually feel like they can put it into a plant and run it and know that it will work. And these are things that have never been developed or used before. This is not off-the-shelf processing. These you don't buy these from DuPont. You have to invent these yourself. And so, it's a great satisfaction for us to see the science actually make its way into the applications. And I'd mentioned in one earlier slide, I didn't bring attention to it, but we just added up in the last 5 years the innovations that we've brought and worked together with our partners to get in place are going to save $5 billion for this cleanup program. That's a whole year's worth of their budget. And it's not just someday. I mean, we've already accounted for over $2 billion of that savings. And these are things like improving the glass waste loading. I mean, it's a 40% improvement in how much waste you can put in each canister means that there's 1,400 canisters we'll never make. Being able to have a solvent that has such a high selectivity that now even in the pilot facility we can meet regulatory standards. These are things that, and one of the lessons from all this is that you don't do it and then walk away. You stay with it throughout. And I think that's really been the key to success when is that the close partnership with the operating entities has continued. And we've continued to bring new science when it's available to continue to advance and develop the efficiency of these processes. So it's a great model, and frankly, it's one that Hanford doesn't have. And we're gonna go help them with that. But anyway, I appreciate you putting me back on the schedule. Sorry again, I had to be a no-show at the last one, but it's always a pleasure, so thanks. Thank you.
Sorry that your national security lab is hard to tell how important that is and how what y'all are doing.
So let me give you an example. So when part of this initiative that we're in right now is to really round up and secure nuclear materials around the world that we really don't want to have just sitting around. And this is a presidential initiative. And so the president every 2 years they have a summit and they talk about this. The last three of those summits we have owned every one of the outcomes of that. And it's like a half hour before the president's going on the stage in South Korea and they call and ask, have we got it done? They call this laboratory and ask whether we've got it done so the president can announce it. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It energizes our people in ways that you can only, I'm sure you can imagine.
So you have the same demographic. Everybody at one time or another, people are aging out.
Yeah.
Are you having trouble? Are you having trouble getting? I know that Dr. Garcia Diaz is very young. So are you getting good? Are you able to?
Very young is a different bar in our. Well, let's just say most of our, a lot of our people have PhDs and have done postdocs, so they, a young person is still. But it's a concern of mine. Is there talent out there? Are we training people who are suitable to come into these kind of jobs? And then are we getting them at our laboratory? I've been very impressed with the quality of people we're hiring, and Steve is actually on my external advisory board, and one of the things I tasked them is to meet with my young research staff and see what's their opinion, because I'm going to think they're great no matter what, but actually I feel very good about the quality. What I'm most concerned about is that we have academic programs that align people in the nuclear sciences, and that's a real challenge. And in fact, it's an assignment I have from the secretary right now to assess what is the future look like for our ability to maintain a nuclear science and technology component in this country. And that's probably the thing I worry about the most. There certainly aren't, and it's just is this the exciting thing you want to go into, or do you want to go into nanobio something, right? And so it's really important for us to get these students in early, to get interns, postdocs, because what happens is once they get in there, they say, oh my gosh, this is really challenging and interesting stuff. But you wouldn't know that, it's like, you're cleaning up what? It's just, doesn't seem that interesting. So for us, we've got to make sure that we're embedded with these programs, that we're getting to the students early on and allowing them to really see what it is and vote with the knowledge of having been there. And so the intern programs and postdoc programs are actually very good recruiting tools and pipelines for us. We recruit from across the country, and we do well across the country. So it's something we always have to be looking at. But right now, I'm saying I'm more concerned about what's the pipeline out there than my ability to get them. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Before I go to public comments, I just want to tell you that we postponed the mock presentations because when I was planning this way back a couple months ago, I didn't know that the report was going to be the mocks, the plutonium alternative disposition report was going to be out next week. Since it's coming out next week, I figured it'd be better not to have them come and give us an update of the status of how the report is coming, but to come back in July and tell us what the report says. So stay tuned. We'll have mocks in July. Tom Clements is the only one who signed up for public comments. Tom will let you make yours, and then I'll ask anybody else if they want.
Thanks, Karen and the council. I am Tom Clements, the director of Savannah Riverside Watch, and I won't say too much, but I prepared a document for you on plutonium disposition and mocks. Karen, I'll give you a hard copy, and I'll also submit a hard copy. But first, I'd like to say I appreciate the effort of DHEC to hold DOE to the schedule that was agreed in the Federal Facilities Agreement. I know that there has to be some flexibility, but the emptying of the tanks and the vitrification of the waste in those tanks is, as I said before, is rather an unsung success at Savannah Riverside. I think that the rate of filling the canisters should be increased. I agree with Ms. Wilson on that, and that DOE should secure more money. But it's one of the overlooked things at Savannah Riverside, particularly in comparison to Hanford, that Savannah Riverside has done well. So I congratulate DOE on that, and I hope more money will come to continue the work. And just briefly, on the issue of the import of graphite spent fuel from Germany, the department has postponed release of a draft environmental assessment now for about the fourth month. Who knows if that is coming out fairly soon, but I would request that you ask for a briefing on the import of that material or what the next step is going to be, whether it's going to be an environmental impact statement or that the program is going to be dropped. But I would guess before your July meeting that we'll know more about that. And I also think we'll know more about legal action that may be taken in Germany and before the European Commission, as there is a huge question about the legality of exporting commercial spent fuel, particularly for reprocessing. So I would probably have more information about that at your July meeting. And just briefly, on the MOX issue, I'm participating with a couple of colleagues on a program related to the status of WIP and disposition of transuranic waste. And I was lucky enough to go out to the Idaho National Lab in early March and had a very good site tour and watched the exhumation of some of the barrels that had been dumped at Idaho National Lab from Rocky Flats. There were also some barrels that we observed on a pad, and that pad is now under a cover in a building, and the waste pits that are being exhumed are also basically in buildings, so there's negative pressure so that handling the plutonium doesn't escape. But it's a mess out there. They've repackaged a lot of the transuranic waste. That mission has to continue, but comparing it to what the transuranic waste situation at Savannah Riverside, it's just stunningly different. And because of this project, recently the three of us doing it, from a colleague from Idaho and a colleague from New Mexico, we requested a tour of Savannah Riverside, including the E area. And as you know, there's not a lot of transuranic waste at Savannah Riverside, but comparing it to Idaho, it's just worlds different, and it's almost pristine at Savannah Riverside as far as transuranic waste goes. On the Savannah Riverside tour, getting to this document that I prepared for you, we did have a stop in front of the MOX plant. I've been engaged with particularly one individual and know some others who have been making some allegations or rumors that there are construction problems in the MOX plant, that cable trays, piping were installed incorrectly and at the wrong elevation, that the inspectors checked off on these things because of incentives being to be won by the contractor and milestones to be met. Switchgear installation was also reported to have been improperly done, as was tagging of wiring. I was surprised that the NNSA, at least when we stopped in front of the MOX plant, did confirm that there had been installation problems. Some of the cable trays and piping, we were told, had been removed, but there's still legacy hardware that was installed improperly. The plutonium report that you mentioned, Ms. Patterson, may get into some of this if it does come out next week. I'm going to look forward to what they have to say, but I was at least pleased that NNSA would confirm some of the rumors, because they're not very prone to talking about much of anything related to the MOX program. And just one other point, and I'll leave this document with you. You can read it if you want. It was also stated that the staff turnover at the MOX plant is 50% a year. And that has just gone up dramatically. I know because of the problems, people are leaving, people are going there to get trained. And it's been told to me by people who've worked at the MOX plant, they're going to work at VC Summer or Plant Vogtle, which is closer to Savannah Riverside. But I don't see how the project can be sustainable with that kind of turnover and not getting properly qualified staff in. The plutonium disposition report that DOE is going to release possibly next week gets into MOX and the disposition of plutonium as waste. The budget, as you know, for MOX is $345 million for last year, and that's a request this year. If you go back and look at the budget, the startup cost of the MOX plant alone, DOE estimates is $1.8 billion. So if you apply the current year's budget to the startup cost alone, I don't see how the math works, and I've challenged this over the years, and nobody has told me how this project is financially sustainable. When we visited the site a couple weeks ago, NNSA admitted that the $345 million is $200 million less than they need to efficiently carry out construction. My guesstimate is the MOX plant, the MOX program, needs about $800 million a year. The operating cost estimate in the budget request of February is $670 million. So the math just does not work. So where is this project going? Where is plutonium disposition going? I appreciate you're gonna hopefully get a briefing about not only the MOX program, but about other disposition alternatives in July, and I would plan to be here and make a few more comments, but I'll leave this with you for your review if you would like. And it has a lot more in it than I've mentioned here. Thank you.
Any other public comments? Then I will see you again in July the 9th, I think. On your calendar, it's the second Thursday, the third month in the quarter or something like that. January, April, July, and October, the second Thursday. It's hard for people to remember that. Thank you all very much. Last dismissed.